Water grey morning light flooded through their bedroom windows. Good Friday and Boxing Day were the two precious days of the year when they never scheduled anything. Tomorrow, she'd be frantic, preparing for the Easter Sunday lunch. But today, there would be no guests, no homework, no rushing, not even grocery shopping. The air was chilly, the bed warm. John Paul murdered Rachel Crowley's daughter. The thought settled on her chest, compressing her heart. She would never again lie in bed on a Good Friday morning and relax in the blissful knowledge that there was nothing to do and nowhere to be. Because for the rest of her life, there would always, always be something left undone. She was lying on her side, with her back up against John Paul. She could feel the warm weight of his arm across her waist. Her husband. Her husband, the murderer. Should she have known? Should she have guessed? The nightmares, the migraines, the times when he was so stubborn and strange. It wouldn't have made any difference, but it made her feel somehow negligent. That's just him, she'd tell herself. She kept replaying memories of their marriage in light of what she now knew. She remembered, for example, how he'd refused to try for a fourth child. "Let's try for a boy," Cecilia had said to him when Polly was a toddler, knowing that both of them would have been perfectly happy if they'd ended up with four girls. John Paul had mystified her with his stubborn refusal to consider it. It was probably yet another example of his self-flagellation. He'd probably been desperate for a boy. Think of something else. Maybe she should get up and make a start on the baking for Sunday. How would she cope with all those guests, all that conversation, all that happiness? John Paul's mother would sit in her favorite armchair, full of righteousness, holding court, sharing the secret. "It was all such a long time ago," she'd said. "But it must feel like yesterday to Rachel." Cecilia remembered with a lurch that Rachel had said today was the anniversary of Janie's death. Did John Paul know that? Probably not. He was terrible with dates. He didn't remember his own wedding anniversary unless she reminded him. Why would he remember the day he killed a girl? "Jesus Christ," she said softly to herself as the physical symptoms of her new disease came rushing back. The nausea, the headache. She had to get up. She had to somehow escape from it. She went to throw back the covers and felt John Paul's arm tighten around her. "I'm getting up," she said, without turning to face him. "How do you think we'd cope financially?" he said into her neck. He sounded hoarse, as if he had a terrible cold. "If I do go to... without my salary, we'd have to sell the house, right?" "We'd survive," answered Cecilia shortly. She took care of the finances. Always had. John Paul was happy to be oblivious to bills and mortgage payments. "Really? We would?" He sounded doubtful. The Fitzpatricks were relatively wealthy, and John Paul had grown up expecting to be better off than most people he knew. If there was money around, he quite naturally assumed it must emanate from him. Cecilia hadn't deliberately misled him about how much money she'd been earning the last few years. She just hadn't got around to mentioning it. He said, "I was thinking that if I'm not here, we could get one of Pete's boys to come around and do odd jobs for you. Like clearing the gutters. That's really important. You can't let that go, Cecilia. Especially around bushfire season. I'll have to do a list. I keep thinking of things." She lay still. Her heart thudded. How could this be? It was absurd, impossible. Were they actually lying in bed talking about John Paul going to jail? I really wanted to be the one to teach the girls how to drive, he said. His voice broke. They've got to know how to handle wet roads. You don't know how to brake properly when the roads are wet. I do so, protested Cecilia. She turned around to face him and saw that he was sobbing, his cheeks crumpled into ugly, grizzled folds. He twisted his head to bury his face in the pillow, as if to hide his tears. I know I have no right to cry. I just can't imagine not seeing them each morning. Rachel Crowley never gets to see her daughter again. But she couldn't harden her heart enough. The part of him she loved best was the part that loved his daughters. Their children had bound them together in a way she knew didn't always happen to other couples. Sharing stories about the girls, laughing about them, wondering about their futures, was one of the greatest pleasures of her marriage. She'd married John Paul because of the father she knew he would be. What will they think of me? He pressed his hands to his face. They'll hate me. It's all right, said Cecilia. This was unbearable. It will be all right. Nothing is going to happen. Nothing is going to change. But I don't know. Now I've actually said it out loud. Now that you know, after all these years, it feels so real, more real than ever before. It's today, you know. He ran the back of his hand across his nose and looked at her. Today is the day. I remember every year. I hate autumn. But this year, it seems even more shocking than ever. I can't believe it was me. I can't believe I did that to someone's daughter. And now my girls have to pay. The remorse racked his whole body, like the worst sort of pain. Her every instinct was to ease it, to rescue him, to somehow make the pain stop. She gathered him to her like a child and whispered soothing words. Shh, it's all right. Everything is going to be all right. There couldn't possibly be new evidence after all these years. Rachel must be mistaken. Come on now. Deep breaths. He buried his face in her shoulder, and she felt his tears soaking through her nightie. Everything is going to be fine, she told him. She knew this couldn't possibly be true. But as she stroked the military straight line of John Paul's graying hair on his neck, she finally understood something about herself. She would never ask him to confess. It seemed that all her vomiting in gutters and crying in pantries had been for show, because as long as nobody else was accused, she would keep his secret. Cecilia Fitzpatrick, who always volunteered first, who never sat quietly when something needed to be done, who always brought casseroles and gave up her time, who knew the difference between right and wrong, was prepared to look the other way. She could, and she would, allow another mother to suffer. Her goodness had limits. She could have easily gone her whole life without knowing those limits. But now she knew exactly where they lay. Chapter 44 Don't be so stingy with the butter, demanded Lucy. Hot cross buns are meant to be served dripping with butter. Have I taught you nothing? Have you heard nothing of the word cholesterol? said Tess. But she picked up the butter knife. She and her mother and Liam were sitting in the backyard in the morning sun drinking tea and eating toasted hot cross buns. Tess's mother was wearing her pink quilted dressing gown over her nightie, and Tess and Liam were wearing their pyjamas. The day had started out suitably dour for a Good Friday, but had suddenly changed its mind and decided to twirl about and show off its autumn colours after all. There was a brisk, flirty breeze, and the sun was pouring through the leaves of her mother's flame tree. "Mum," said Liam, with his mouth full. "Mm?" said Tess. She held her face up to the sun, her eyes closed. She felt peaceful and sleepy. There had been more sex last night in Connor's apartment after they'd come back from the beach. It was even more spectacular than the previous night. He had certain skills that were really quite outstanding. Had he read a book, perhaps? Will had never read that book. It was curious how last week sex was just a pleasant, semi-regular pastime she never really thought about. And now this week, it was all-consuming. As if it were all that really mattered about life, as if these moments in between sexual encounters were irrelevant, not really living. She felt like she was becoming addicted to Connor, and the particular curve of his upper lip, and the breadth of his shoulders, and his... "Mum," said Liam again. "Yeah?" "Finish what's in your mouth." "When are Daddy and Felicity coming?" "For Easter." Tess opened her eyes and glanced at her mother, who raised her eyebrows. "I'm not sure," she said to Liam. "I have to talk to them. They might have to work."
"They can't work at Easter. I want to see Dad headbutt my rabbit egg."
Somehow, they'd started the somewhat violent Easter Sunday tradition of beginning the day with the ceremonial headbutting of a chocolate Easter bunny. Will and Liam both found the poor bunny's caved-in face to be hysterically funny. "Well," said Tess. She had no idea what to do about Easter. Was there any point in putting on a happy family show for Liam's benefit? They weren't good enough actors. He'd see right through it. Nobody would expect that of her, surely. Unless she invited Connor. Sit on his lap like a teenage schoolgirl, proving to her ex-boyfriend that she'd moved on to no less than the muscly-armed school jock. She could ask him to roar up on his bike. He could do the headbutting of Liam's chocolate rabbit. He could out-headbutt Will. "We'll call Daddy later on," she told Liam. Her peaceful feeling had vanished.
"Let's call him now."
He ran inside the house.
"No,"
said Tess. But he'd gone. "Deary me," sighed her mother, putting down her hot cross bun. "I don't know what to do," began Tess. But Liam came running straight back with her mobile phone in his outstretched hand. It beeped with a text message as he went to hand it over.
"Is that a message from Dad?"
said Liam. Tess grabbed for the phone in panic. "No, I don't know. Let me see." The message was from Connor. "Thinking of you. Kiss, kiss." Tess smiled. As soon as she read it, the phone beeped again.
"This one is probably from Dad."
Liam bounced in front of her on the balls of his feet as if he were playing soccer. Tess read the text. It was another one from Connor. "It's a good kite day if you want to bring Liam up to the oval for a quick run. I'll supply the kite. But understand if you think it's not a good idea. They're not from your dad, Tess said to Liam. They're from Mr. Whitby. You know, your new PE teacher. Liam looked blank. Lucy cleared her throat.
Mr. Whitby, said Tess again. You had him for...
Why is he texting you? Said Liam.
Are you going to finish your hot cross bun, Liam? Asked Lucy.
Mr. Whitby is actually an old friend of mine, said Tess. Remember how I saw him in the school office? I knew him years ago. Before you were born.
Tess, said her mother. There was a warning note in her voice.
What? Said Tess irritably. Why shouldn't she tell Liam that Connor was an old friend? What was the harm in that?
Does Daddy know him too? Said Liam.
Children seemed so clueless about grown-up relationships, and then all of a sudden they'd say something like that. Something that showed that on some level they understood everything.
No, said Tess. It was before I knew your dad.
Anyway, Mr. Whitby texted because he's got this great kite, and he wondered if you and I would like to go up to the Oval and fly it.
Huh?
Liam scowled, as if she'd suggested he clean up his room.
Tess, my love, do you really think that's, you know...
Tess's mother held up the side of her hand as a shield and silently mouthed the word, appropriate? Tess ignored her. She would not be made to feel guilty about this.
Why should she and Liam stay at home here doing nothing while Will and Felicity did whatever the hell it was they were doing today?
Anyway, she wanted to show that therapist, that invisible critical presence in Connor's life, that Tess wasn't just some crazy damaged woman using Connor for sex. She was good. She was nice.
He's got this amazing kite, improvised Tess. He just thought you might like to have a turn flying it, that's all.
She glanced at her mother. He's being friendly because we're new at the school. She turned back to Liam. Shall we go and meet him? Just for half an hour?
All right, said Liam grudgingly. But I want to call Dad first.
Once you're dressed, said Tess, go put your jeans on and your rugby top. It's chillier than I thought.
All right, said Liam and slouched off.
She tapped out a text to Connor. We'll see you on the Oval in half an hour. Kiss, kiss. Just before she was about to hit send, she deleted the kisses, in case the therapist thought that was leading him on. Then she thought of all the actual kissing they'd done last night. Ridiculous. She may just as well kiss him in a text message. She made it 3 kisses and went to hit send, but then she wondered if it would seem overly romantic and changed it back to 1 kiss. But that seemed stingy compared to his 2, as if she was trying to make a point. She made a sound, added back in the 2nd kiss, and hit send. She looked up to see her mother watching her.
What?
She said.
Careful, said her mother.
What do you mean by that exactly? There was a truculent tone in Tess's voice she recognized from her teenage years.
I just mean you don't want to go so far down a path that you can't come back, said her mother.
Tess glanced at the back door to check that Liam was inside. There's nothing to come back for.
Obviously, there must have been something badly wrong with our marriage.
Rubbish! Interrupted her mother with such vehemence.
Bollocks! That's the sort of rubbish you read in women's magazines.
This is what happens in life. People mess up.
We're designed to be attracted to each other. It absolutely does not mean there was something wrong with your marriage. I've seen you and Will together.
I know how much you love each other.
But Mum, Will fell in love with Felicity. It wasn't just a drunken kiss at an office party. It's love.
She frowned at her fingernails and lowered her voice to a whisper.
And maybe I'm falling in love with Connor.
So what? People fall in and out of love all the time. I fell in love with Beryl's son-in-law just the other week. It's not some sign that your marriage was damaged.
Lucy took a bite of her hot cross bun and spoke with her mouth full.
Of course, it's very badly damaged now.
Tess guffawed and lifted her palms.
So there you go. We're stuffed. Not if you're both prepared to let go of your egos.
It's not just about our egos, said Tess irritably.
This was ridiculous. Her mother wasn't making any sense. Beryl's son-in-law, for heaven's sake.
Oh, Tess, my darling, at your age, everything is about your ego.
So, what are you saying? I should forget my ego and beg Will to come back to me?
Lucy rolled her eyes. Of course not. I'm just saying, don't burn your bridges by jumping straight into a relationship with Connor. You have to think about Liam.
Tess was outraged. I am thinking about Liam.
She paused.
Did you think about me when you and Dad split up?
Her mother gave her a small, humble smile.
Maybe not as much as we should have.
She lifted her teacup and put it back down again.
Sometimes I look back and think, goodness me, we took our feelings so seriously. Everything was black and white. We got into our positions and that was that. We wouldn't budge.
Whatever happens, don't get all rigid, Tess. Be prepared to be a bit bendy.
Bendy, repeated Tess. Her mother held up one hand and tilted her head.
Was that the doorbell?
I didn't hear it, said Tess. If that's my damn sister showing up here unannounced again, I'll be so cross.
Lucy straightened and narrowed her eyes.
Don't offer her a cup of tea, whatever you do.
I think you imagined it, said Tess.
Mum! Grandma!
The screen door at the back of the house flew open, and Liam tumbled out, still wearing his pajamas, his face alight.
Look, he's here!
He held the screen door wide and made a big game show host gesture.
Ta-da!
A beautiful blonde woman stepped through the open door. There was a split second where Tess genuinely didn't recognize her and simply admired the stylish effect she created in the autumn leaves. She was wearing one of those chunky white knit cardigans with brown wooden buttons, a brown leather belt, skinny blue jeans, and boots.
It's Felicity!
Crowed Liam.
Chapter 45. Just sit with your mum and relax, said Lauren to Rob. I'll bring out some hot cross buns and coffee. Jacob, you come with me, mister.
Rachel let herself sink into a cushiony couch next to a wood stove. It was comfortable. The couch had the exact right level of softness, which was to be expected. Thanks to Lauren's impeccable taste, everything in their beautifully restored two-bedroom Federation cottage was exactly right. The cafe that Lauren had originally suggested had been closed, much to her chagrin.
I called and double-checked what time they were opening just yesterday, she'd said when they saw the closed sign across the door. Rachel had watched with interest as she almost lost her cool, but she'd managed to recover herself and suggest that they go back to their place. It was closer than Rachel's place, and Rachel hadn't been able to think of a reason to refuse without seeming churlish. Rob sat down in a red and white striped armchair opposite her and yawned. Rachel caught the yawn and immediately sat up straighter. She did not want to nod off in Lauren's house like an old lady. She looked at her watch. It was only just after 8 a.m. There were still hours and hours to endure before the day was done. At this time, 28 years ago, Janie had been eating her very last breakfast. Half a Weet-Bix, probably. She'd never liked breakfast. Rachel ran her palm over the fabric of the couch. "What will you do with all your lovely furniture when you move to New York?" she said to Rob, chattily, coolly. She could talk about the upcoming move to New York on the anniversary of Janie's death. Oh, yes, she could. Rob took a few moments to answer. He stared at his knees. She was about to say, "Rob?" when he finally spoke. "We might rent this place out furnished," he said, as if speaking was an effort. "We're still thinking about all those logistics." "Yes, a lot to think about, I imagine," said Rachel snappily. "Yes, Rob, quite a lot of logistics involved in taking my grandson to New York." She dug her fingernails into the cloth of the couch, as if it were a soft, fat animal she was abusing. "Do you dream about Janie, Mum?" asked Rob. Rachel looked up. She released the flesh of the couch. "Yes," she said. "Do you?" "Sort of," said Rob. "I have nightmares that I'm being strangled. I guess I'm dreaming that I'm Janie. It's always the same. I wake up choking for air. The dreams are always worse around this time of year. Autumn. Lauren thought maybe going to the park with you might be good. To face up to it. I don't know. I didn't really like being there." "That's the wrong way to put it. Obviously you don't like being there either. But I just found that really hard. Thinking of what she went through. How scared she must have been. Jesus." He looked up at the ceiling and his face buckled. Rachel remembered how Ed would fiercely resist tears in exactly the same way. Ed used to have nightmares too. Rachel would wake up to hear him yelling over and over, "Run, Janie! Run! For God's sake, darling, run!" "I'm sorry. I didn't know you had nightmares," said Rachel. What could she have done about it? Rob got his face back under control. "They're just dreams. They're no big deal. But you shouldn't have to go to the park every year on your own, Mum. I'm sorry I never offered to go with you before. I should have." "Sweetheart, you did offer," said Rachel. "Don't you remember?" "Many times. And I always said no. It was my thing. Your dad thought I was crazy. He never went to that park. Never even drove along the same street." Rob wiped the back of his hand across his nose and sniffed. "Sorry," he said. "You'd think that after all these years..." He stopped abruptly. They could hear Jacob in the kitchen, singing the words to the Bob the Builder soundtrack. Lauren was singing along too. Rob smiled tenderly at the sound. The smell of hot cross buns drifted into the room. Rachel studied his face. He was a good dad. A better dad than his own father had been. That was the way these days, All the men seemed to be better fathers. But Rob had always been a soft-hearted boy. Even as a baby, he'd been a loving little thing. She used to pick him up from his cot after a nap, and he'd snuggle against her chest and actually pat her back, as if to thank her for picking him up. He'd been the most chuckly, kissable baby. She remembered Ed saying without resentment, "For God's sake, woman, you're besotted with that child." It was strange remembering Rob as a baby. Like picking up a much-loved book she hadn't read in years. She so rarely bothered to think about memories of Rob. Instead, she was always trying to scrape up new memories of Janie's childhood, as if Rob's childhood didn't matter, because he got to live. "You are the most beautiful baby," she said to Rob. "People used to stop me in the street to compliment me. Have I told you that before?" "Probably 100 times. Rob shook his head slowly. "You never told me that, Mum." "Didn't I?" said Rachel. "Not even when Jacob was born?" "No." There was an expression of wonder on his face. "Well, I should have," said Rachel. She sighed. "I probably should have done a lot of things." Rob leaned forward, his elbows resting on his knees. "So I was pretty cute, eh?" "You were gorgeous, darling," said Rachel. "You still are, of course." Rob snorted. "Yeah, right, Mum." But he couldn't hide the delight that suddenly wreathed his face. And Rachel bit down hard on her lower lip, with regret for all the ways she'd let him down. "Hot cross buns!" Lauren appeared, carrying a beautiful platter of perfectly toasted and evenly buttered buns, which she placed in front of them. "Let me help," said Rachel. "Absolutely not," said Lauren. She said over her shoulder as she returned to the kitchen, "You never let me help at your place." "Ah." Rachel felt strangely exposed. She always assumed that Lauren didn't really notice her actions, or even register her as a person at all. She thought of her age as a shield that protected her from the eyes of the young. She always pretended to herself that she didn't let Lauren help because she was trying to be the perfect mother-in-law. But really, when you didn't let a woman help, it was a way of keeping her at a distance, of letting her know that she wasn't family, of saying, "I don't like you enough to let you into my kitchen." Lauren reappeared with another tray containing 3 coffee cups. The coffee would be perfect, made exactly the way Rachel liked it, hot with 2 sugars. Lauren was the perfect daughter-in-law. Rachel was the perfect mother-in-law. All that perfection, hiding all that dislike. But Lauren had won. New York was her ace. She'd played it. Good on her. "Where's Jacob?" said Rachel. "He's drawing," said Lauren as she sat down. She lifted her mug and shot Rob a wry look. "Hopefully not on the walls." Rob grinned at her, and Rachel got another glimpse of the private world of their marriage. It seemed like it was a good marriage, as far as marriages went. Would Janie have liked Lauren? Would Rachel have been a nice, ordinary, overbearing mother-in-law if Janie had lived? It was impossible to imagine. The world with Lauren in it was so vastly different from the world when Janie had been alive. It seemed impossible that Lauren would still have existed if Janie had lived. She looked at Lauren, strands of fair hair escaping from her ponytail. It was nearly the same blonde as Janie's. Janie's hair was blonder. Perhaps hers would have got darker as she'd got older. Ever since that first morning after Janie died, when she woke up and the horror of what had happened crashed down upon her, Rachel had been obsessively imagining another life running alongside her own. Her real life, the one that was stolen from her, the one where Janie was warm in her bed. But as the years had gone by, it had grown harder and harder to imagine it. Lauren was sitting right in front of her, and she was so alive, the blood pumping through her veins, her chest rising and falling. "You okay, Mum?" said Rob. "I'm fine," said Rachel. She went to reach for her cup of coffee and found that she didn't have the energy to even lift her arm. Sometimes there was the pure, primal pain of grief, and other times there was anger, the frantic desire to claw and hit and kill. And sometimes, like right now, there was just this ordinary, dull sensation, settling itself softly, suffocatingly over her, like a heavy fog. She was just so damned sad. Chapter 46. "Hello," said Felicity. Tess smiled at her. She couldn't help it. It was like the way you automatically say thank you to a police officer who's handing you a speeding ticket you don't want and can't afford. She was automatically happy to see Felicity because she loved her and she looked so nice and because a lot had been happening to her over the last few days and she had so much to tell her. In the very next instant, she remembered, and the shock and betrayal felt brand new. Tess battled the desire to fly at Felicity, to knock her to the ground and scratch and pummel and bite. But nice, middle-class women like Tess didn't behave like that, especially not in front of their impressionable small children. So she did nothing except lick her greasy lips from the buttery hot cross buns and move forward in her chair, tugging at the front of her pajama top. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "I'm sorry for just..." Felicity's voice disappeared on her. She tried to clear her throat and said huskily, "Turning up like this, without calling." "Yes, it might have been better if you had called," said Lucy. Tess knew her mother was trying her best to look forbidding, but she just looked distraught. In spite of all the things she'd said about Felicity, Tess knew that Lucy loved her niece. "How is your ankle?" Felicity asked Lucy.
"Is Dad coming too?"
said Liam. Tess straightened. Felicity met her eyes and quickly looked away. "That's right. Ask Felicity. Felicity would know what Will's plans were."
"He's coming soon," Felicity told Liam. "I'm not actually staying long. I just wanted to talk to your mum first about a few things, and then I've got to go. I'm, going away, actually."
"Where to?" asked Liam.
"I'm going to England," said Felicity. "I'm going to do this amazing walk. It's called the Coast to Coast Walk. And then I'm going to Spain and America. Well, anyway, I'm going to be away for quite a long time."
"Are you going to Disneyland?" asked Liam.
Tess stared at Felicity. "I don't get it. Was Will going with her on some romantic adventure?" Red, painful blotches stained Felicity's neck.
"Could you and I talk?"
Tess stood up.
"Come on."
"I'll come too," said Liam.
"No," said Tess.
"You stay out here with me, darling," said Lucy. "Let's eat chocolate."
Tess took Felicity to her old bedroom. It was the only door with a lock. They stood next to her bed,
looking at each other. Tessa's heart hammered. She hadn't realized that you could spend your whole life looking at the people you loved in an oblique, half-hearted way, as if you were deliberately blurring your vision, until something like this happened, and then just looking at that person could be terrifying. "What's going on?" said Tess. "It's over," said Felicity.
"Over?"
"Well, it never got started, really. Once you and Liam were gone, it just
wasn't as thrilling anymore."
"Can I sit down?" said Felicity. "My legs are shaking." Tessa's legs were shaking too. She shrugged. "Sure. Sit." There was nowhere to sit but the bed or the floor. Felicity sank to the floor. She sat cross-legged with her back against the chest of drawers. Tess sat also, with her back against the bed. "Still the same rug." Felicity put her hand on the blue and white rug. "Yep." Tess looked at Felicity's slim legs and fine-boned wrists. She thought of the little fat girl who had sat in that exact same position so many times throughout their childhood, her beautiful green almond eyes shining out from her plump face. Tess had always known there was a fairy princess trapped in there. Perhaps Tess had liked the fact that she was trapped. "You look beautiful," said Tess. For some reason, it just had to be said.
"Don't," said Felicity. "I wasn't trying to make a point."
"I know." They sat in silence for a few moments.
"So tell me," said Tess finally.
"He's not in love with me," said Felicity. "I don't think he was ever in love with me. It was a crush. The whole thing was pathetic, really. I knew straight away, as soon as you and Liam were gone, I knew that nothing was going to happen."
"But..."
Tess lifted her hands helplessly. She felt a rush of humiliation. The events of the past week all seemed so stupid.
"It wasn't just a crush for me," said Felicity. She lifted her chin. "It was real for me. I love him. I've loved him for years."
"Is that right?" said Tess dully. But it wasn't a surprise. Not really. Maybe she'd always known it. In fact, maybe she'd even liked the fact that she'd sensed Felicity was in love with Will, because it had made Will seem all the more desirable, and because it had been perfectly safe. There had been no way that Will could have been sexually attracted to Felicity. Had Tess never really seen her cousin at all? Had she been just like everyone else who hadn't seen past Felicity's weight? She said, "But all those years, spending so much time with us, it must have been horrible." It was as though she'd thought that Felicity's fatness cushioned her feelings, as though she believed that Felicity must surely know and accept that no ordinary man could really love her. And yet, Tess would have killed anyone who might have said that out loud. "It was just how I felt." Felicity pleated the fabric of her jeans between her fingers. "I knew he just thought of me as a friend. I knew Will liked me, loved me even, like a sister. It was enough to spend time with him."
"You should have," began Tess.
"What?"
"Told you."
"How could I tell you? What could you have done except feel sorry for me? What I should have done was gone off and got my own life instead of just being your faithful fat sidekick."
"I never thought of you like that."
Tess was stung. I'm not saying you thought of me like that. It was more that I saw myself as your sidekick. As if I wasn't thin enough to have a real life. But then I lost weight, and I started to notice men looking at me. I know as good feminists we're not meant to like it, being objectified. But when you've never experienced it, it's like, I don't know, cocaine. I loved it. I felt so powerful. It was like in those movies when the superhero first discovers their powers. And then I thought, I wonder if I could get Will to notice me now, like those other men notice me. And then, well, then she stopped. She'd got caught up in the telling of her story and forgotten that it wasn't really an appropriate one for Tess to hear. Tess had only had a few days of not being able to talk to Felicity, whereas Felicity had all those years of not being able to share the biggest thing on her mind. "And then he noticed you," finished Tess. "You tried out your superpowers, and they worked." Felicity gave a pretty, self-deprecating shrug. It was funny how all her gestures were different now. Tess was sure she'd never seen that particular shrug before. Sort of French and flirty. I think Will felt so bad about feeling, you know, a little bit attracted to me. He convinced himself that he was in love with me, said Felicity. Once you and Liam were gone, everything changed. I think he lost interest in me the moment you walked out the door. "The moment I walked out the door," repeated Tess. "Yep. Bullshit." Felicity lifted her head. "It's true." "No, it's not." It seemed as though Felicity was trying to absolve Will of all wrongdoing, to imply that he'd been briefly led astray, as if what had happened was no different than the betrayal of a drunken kiss at an office party. Tess thought of Will's dead white face on Monday evening. He wasn't that shallow or stupid. His feelings for Felicity had been real enough for him to begin the process of dismantling his whole life. It was Liam, she thought. The moment Tess walked out the door with Liam, Will finally understood what he was sacrificing. If there was no child involved, this conversation wouldn't be taking place. He loved Tess. Presumably he did. But right now he was in love with Felicity. And everyone knew which was the more powerful feeling. It wasn't a fair fight. It was why marriages fell apart. It was why, if you valued your marriage, you kept a barricade around yourself and your feelings and your thoughts. You didn't let your eyes linger. You didn't stay for the second drink. You kept the flirting safe. You just didn't go there. At some point, Will had made a choice to look at Felicity with the eyes of a single man. That was the moment he had betrayed Tess. "Obviously, I'm not asking for your forgiveness," said Felicity. "Yes, you are," thought Tess, "but you're not getting it." "Because I could have done it," said Felicity. "I want you to know that. For some reason, it's really important to me that you know that I was serious. I felt terrible, but not so terrible that I couldn't have done it. I could have lived with myself." Tess stared at her, appalled. "I just want to be totally honest with you," said Felicity.
"Thanks, I guess."
Felicity dropped her eyes first. "Anyway, I thought the best thing would be for me to just leave the country, to get as far away as possible. So you and Will can work things out. He wanted to talk to you first, but I thought it would make more sense if..."
"So where is he now?" said Tess. There was a strident note to her voice. Felicity's knowledge of Will's whereabouts and plans was infuriating. Is he in Sydney? Did you fly up together?
Well, yes, we did, but...
began Felicity. That must have been very traumatic for you both. Your last moments together. Did you hold hands on the plane? The flicker in Felicity's eyes was indisputable. You did, didn't you? Said Tess. She could just imagine it. The agony. The star-crossed lovers clinging to each other, wondering if they should keep on running, fly to Paris, or do the right thing, the boring thing. Tess was the boring thing. I don't want him, she told Felicity. She couldn't stand her role as the stodgy, wronged wife. She wanted Felicity to know that there was nothing stodgy about Tess O'Leary. You can have him. Keep him. I've been sleeping with Connor Whitby. Felicity's mouth dropped. Seriously? Seriously. Felicity exhaled. Well, Tess, that's... I don't know. She looked around the room for inspiration and returned her gaze to Tess. 3 days ago, you said you would not have Liam growing up with divorced parents. You said you wanted your husband back. You made me feel like the worst person in the world. And now you tell me that you've just jumped straight into an affair with an ex-boyfriend, while Will and I, we never even... God! She thumped her fist on the side of Tess's bed, her colour high, her eyes shining with fury. The injustice, and perhaps the justice, of Felicity's words took Tess's breath away. Don't be so pious! She shoved Felicity's skinny thigh as hard as she could, childishly, like a kid on a bus. It felt strangely good. She did it again, harder. You are the worst person in the world. Do you think I would have even looked at Connor if you and Will hadn't made your announcement? You didn't muck about, though, did you? Bloody hell! Stop hitting me! Tess gave her one final shove and sat back. She had never felt such an overwhelming desire to hit someone before. She had certainly never given in to it. It seemed that all the niceties that made her a socially acceptable grown-up had been stripped away. Last week she was a school mum and a professional. Now she was having sex in hallways and hitting her cousin. What next? She took a deep, shaky breath. In the heat of the moment, they called it. She had never realized just how hot the heat of the moment could get. Anyway, said Felicity, Will wants to work things out, and I'm leaving the country. So do whatever you want to do. Thanks, said Tess. Thanks very much. Thanks for everything. She could feel the anger almost physically draining from her body, leaving her limp and detached. There was silence for a moment. He wants another baby, said Felicity. Don't tell me what he wants. He really wants another baby. And I suppose you would have liked to have given him one, said Tess. Felicity's eyes filled. Yes. I'm sorry, but yes. For God's sake, Felicity, don't make me feel bad for you. It's not fair. Why did you have to fall in love with my husband? Why couldn't you have fallen in love with someone else's husband? We never really saw anyone else. Felicity laughed as the tears rolled down her face. She wiped the back of her hand across her nose. That was true. He doesn't think he can ask you to go through another pregnancy because of how sick you got with Liam, said Felicity. But it might not be as bad with a second pregnancy, right? Every pregnancy is different, isn't it? You should have another baby.
Do you really think we're going to have a baby now and live happily ever after? Said Tess. A baby doesn't fix a marriage. Not that I even knew my marriage needed fixing.
I know, I just thought it's not really because of the sickness that I don't want a baby, she said to Felicity. It's because of the people.
The people?
The other mothers, the teachers, the people. I didn't realize that having a child was so social. You're always talking to people.
So what?
Felicity looked mystified.
I have this disorder. I did a quiz in a magazine.
Tess lowered her voice.
I have social anxiety.
You do not, said Felicity dismissively. I do so. I did the quiz.
You're seriously diagnosing yourself based on some quiz in a magazine?
It was Reader's Digest, not Cosmopolitan. And it's true. I can't stand meeting new people. I get sick. I have heart palpitations. I can't stand parties.
Lots of people don't like parties.
Get over yourself.
Tess was taken aback. She had expected hushed pity.
You're shy, said Felicity. You're not one of those loud-mouthed extroverts. But people like you. People really like you. Haven't you ever noticed that? I mean, God, Tess, how could you have had all those boyfriends if you were such a shy, nervy little thing? You had about 30 boyfriends before you were 25.
Tess rolled her eyes. I did not.
How could she explain to Felicity that her anxiety was like a strange, mercurial little pet she was forced to look after? Sometimes it was quiet and pliable. Other days it was crazy, running around in circles, yapping in her ear. Besides, dating was different. Dating had its own definite set of rules. She could do dating. A first date with a new man had never been a problem. As long as he asked her out, of course. She never did the asking. It was when the man asked her to meet his family and friends that her anxiety reared its freaky little head. And by the way, if you really had social anxiety, why did you never tell me? Said Felicity with total confidence that she knew everything there was to know about Tess.
I never had a name for it before, said Tess. I never had words to describe this feeling until a few months ago.
And because you were part of my cover identity. Because you and I pretended together that we didn't care what other people thought of us, that we were superior to just about the whole world. If I'd admitted to you how I felt, I would have had to admit that not only did I care what other people thought, I cared far too much.
You know what? I walked into an aerobics class wearing a size 22 t-shirt.
Felicity leaned forward and looked at her fiercely.
People couldn't look at me. I saw one girl nudging her friend to check me out, and then they both fell about laughing. I heard a guy say, "Watch out for the heifer."
Don't you talk to me about social anxiety, Tess O'Leary. There was a banging on the door.
"Mum! Felicity!"
shouted Liam.
"Why have you locked the door? Let me in!"
"Go away, Liam," called back Tess.
"No! Have you made up yet?"
Tess and Felicity looked at each other. Felicity smiled faintly, and Tess looked away. Lucy's voice came from the other end of the house.
"Liam, come back here! I said to leave your mother alone!"
She was at a disadvantage on her crutches. Felicity stood. I have to go. My flight is at 2 o'clock. Mum and Dad are taking me to the airport. Mum is in a state. Dad isn't speaking to me, apparently.
You're seriously leaving today?
Tess looked up at her from the floor. She thought briefly of the business, the clients she'd worked so hard to win over, the cash flow they'd tried so hard to maintain, fussing and fretting over the profit and loss like a delicate little plant, the work-in-progress Excel spreadsheet they'd studied each morning. Was this the end for TWF advertising? All those dreams, all that stationery.
Yes, said Felicity. It's what I should have done years ago.
Tess stood as well. I don't forgive you.
I know, said Felicity. I don't forgive me either.
Mum! Yelled Liam. Hold your horses, Liam!
Called out Felicity. She grabbed Tess's arm and said in her ear, Don't tell Will about Connor. For one strange moment, they hugged, and then Felicity turned and opened the door. Chapter 47.
There's no butter, announced Isabel. No margarine, either.
She turned from the fridge and looked at her mother expectantly.
Are you sure? Asked Cecilia.
How could that have happened? She never forgot a staple. Her system was foolproof. Her refrigerator and pantry were always perfectly stocked. Sometimes John Paul rang on his way home and asked if she needed him to pick up milk or anything, and she'd always reply, no.
But aren't we having hot cross buns? Said Esther. We always have hot cross buns for breakfast on Good Friday.
We can still have them, said John Paul.
He brushed his fingers automatically across Cecilia's lower back as he walked past her to the kitchen table. Your mother's hot cross buns are so good, they don't need butter. Cecilia watched him. He was pale and a little shaky, as if he was recovering from the flu, and he seemed in a tremulous, tender mood. She found herself waiting for something to happen. The shrill ring of the phone, a heavy knock on the door. But the day continued to be cloaked in soft, safe silence. Nothing would happen on a Good Friday. Good Friday was in its own protective little bubble.
We always have our hot cross buns with lots and lots of butter, said Polly, who was sitting at the kitchen table in her pink flannelette pyjamas, her black hair rumpled, her cheeks flushed with sleep. It's a family tradition. Just go to the shop, Mum, and get some butter.
Don't speak to your mother like that. She's not your slave, said John Paul,
at the same time as Esther glanced up from her library book and said, The shops are closed, stupid.
Whatever, sighed Isabel. I'm going to go Skype with...
No, you're not, said Cecilia. We're all going to eat some porridge, and then we're all going to walk up to the school oval.
Walk,
said Polly disdainfully.
Yes, walk. It's turned into a beautiful day. Or ride your bikes.
We'll take the soccer ball.
I'm on Dad's team, said Isabel.
And then on the way back, we'll stop by at the BP service station and pick up some butter, and we'll have hot cross buns when we get home.
Perfect, said John Paul. That sounds perfect.
Did you know that some people wish the Berlin Wall never came down? Said Esther.
That's weird, isn't it? Why would you want to be stuck behind a wall?
Well, that was lovely, but I really should go, said Rachel. She placed her mug back down on the coffee table. Her duty was done. She shifted herself forward and took a breath. It was another one of those impossibly low couches. Could she stand up on her own? Lauren would get there first if she saw she was having difficulty. Rob was always just a moment too late.
"What are you doing for the rest of the day?" asked Lauren.
"I'll just potter about," said Rachel. "I'll just count the minutes." She held out a hand to Rob. "Give me a hand, will you, love?"
As Rob went to help her, Jacob toddled over with a framed photo he'd picked up from the bookcase and brought it over to Rachel.
"Daddy," he said, pointing.
"That's right," said Rachel. It was a photo of Rob and Janie on a camping holiday they'd taken on the south coast the year before Janie died. They were standing in front of a tent, and Rob was holding his fingers up like rabbit ears behind Janie's head. Why did children insist on doing that? Rob came and stood next to them and pointed at his sister.
"And who's that, buddy?"
"Auntie Janie," said Jacob clearly.
Rachel caught her breath. She'd never heard him say Auntie Janie before, although she and Rob had been pointing her out in photos to him since he was a tiny baby.
"Clever boy." She ruffled his hair. "Your Aunt Janie would have loved you."
Although, in truth, Janie had never been particularly interested in children. She'd preferred constructing cities with Rob's Lego to playing with dolls. Jacob gave her a cynical look, as if he knew this, and wandered off with the photo frame swinging precariously between his fingertips. Rachel put her hand in Rob's, and he helped her to her feet.
"Well, thank you so much, Lauren," she began,
and was disconcerted to see that Lauren was staring at the floor with a fixed expression, as if she was pretending not to be there.
"Sorry," she gave them a watery smile. "It was just hearing Jacob say Auntie Janie for the first time."
"I don't know how you get through this day, Rachel, every year. I really don't. I just wish I could do something."
"You could not take my grandson to New York," thought Rachel. "You could stay here and have another baby."
But she just smiled politely and said, "Thank you, darling. I'm perfectly all right." Lauren stood.
"I wish I'd known her. My sister-in-law. I always wanted a sister."
Her face was pink and soft. Rachel looked away. She couldn't bear it. She didn't want to see evidence of Lauren's vulnerability.
"I'm sure she would have loved you."
Rachel sounded so perfunctory, even to her own ears, that she coughed, embarrassed.